From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, Eye Strangeness with roving reporter Linda Moulton Howard. Here's what's happening in Pittsburgh. Police firing canisters of pepper spray and smoke at marchers protesting the Group of 20 summit after people responded to calls to disperse by rolling trash bins and throwing rocks, they say. The march turned chaotic at just about the time that President Barack Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama arrived for a meeting with leaders of the world's major economies. The clashes began after hundreds of protesters, many advocating against capitalism, tried to march from an outlying neighborhood toward the convention center where the summit is being held. The anti-G20 protesters rampaged through the city center of Pittsburgh tonight, smashing up some shops and throwing rocks at police as officers used tear gas and baton charges in an attempt to bring them under control. And the embattled U.S. dollar is expected to come under scrutiny at the summit of developing and industrialized nations following China-led calls to review its role as a reserve currency. The dollar issue is bound to surface at this several-day meeting in Pittsburgh. Alex Jones, he's on the line with us now. Alex, can you give us some news updates on this situation?
George, yes, I can. I have three InfoWars.com reporters, Rob Dew, Jason Douglas, and Jason Burmes, on the ground. We put out live video and audio feeds today. We have key uncensored videos posted up on the sites right now. What really happened, and this was confirmed by the Denver Post, confirmed by the Toronto Star in the last few years, is that police, posing as anarchists, will tump over a few trash cans in front of the news cameras, and then police will attack the mainline protest. And we witnessed some of this today. It will take time to research and find out if this was police provocateurs, but it has been in the past. And here's the other big news issue. No mainstream media that I've seen, we've been tracking it, has reported this, but we have the video of it, and it almost deafened. In fact, some of my employees literally have ringing ears right now. The U.S. Army, regular Army, National Guard, Air Force MPs were with the police with LRAD acoustic guns, weapons mounted up on the Humvees and other vehicles. They also had microwave guns, but we did not see them use those. But they used all day throughout the city. They would drive around broadcasting that no one was allowed on the streets. They did it on side streets. We have video of empty streets that we shot from inside businesses as they just drove down streets with children on the side of the road, blaring a device that mainstream news has reported has been used in Iraq and is known to damage hearing permanently. This is the first time that this has been used against U.S. citizens. San Diego newspaper reported 2 weeks ago that they had these systems out at the tea parties that the local police did, but they didn't use them. Sound weapons were deployed. Microwave guns are deployed. The sound weapons, the LRADs, were used all over the city. 99% of the thousands of demonstrators who were anti-war, in the Fed, anti-globalist. A lot of my supporters were out there with posters of our websites, and the media only focused on the communist anarchist who, in every case in the past, it's come out later in police documents, were federal or local provocateurs. We haven't proven that yet here, but they fit the modus operandi. And then it got even worse last night. Ahead of all of this, my reporters became the subject of a terrorism investigation.
All right, Alex, I want you to continue to monitor this situation for us. Alex's website's Infowars.com, PrisonPlanet.com. A Colorado airport shuttle driver has been indicted on federal charges of conspiracy to use weapons of mass destruction in a possible Al-Qaeda-linked bomb plot in the United States. Nazibullah Zazi, 24 years old, faces charges of conspiring to use explosives against persons or property here in the United States. Authorities believe that he and others may have been plotting a copycat mass transit attack in New York City, similar to those subways in London and Madrid. Safety investigators told federal regulators 3 years ago that it was dangerous for bus drivers to talk on cell phones while driving, and they recommended a ban. The National Transportation Safety Board put that recommendation on its list of most important safety measures And now Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood will convene a two-day summit next week on distracted driving and plans to announce actions to address cell phone use by bus and truck drivers. The NTSB's recommendation was prompted by a 2004 accident in which the driver of a motor coach carrying students on a trip to Washington became so engrossed in a cell phone conversation that he failed to notice signs that said the height of an upcoming bridge was nearly 2 feet less than the height of the bus. The bus slammed into the underside of the bridge, shearing off the roof and injuring 11 passengers. An experimental HIV vaccine has, for the very first time, cut the risk of infection. The vaccine, a combination of two earlier experimental vaccines, was given to 16,000 people in Thailand in the largest ever such vaccine trial. Researchers found that it reduced by nearly a third the risk of contracting HIV, the virus that leads to AIDS. Home resales dipped unexpectedly last month after a four-month streak of gains, providing evidence that the housing market recovery remains fragile. The National Association of Realtors said that the sales dropped 2.7% to a seasonally adjusted annual rate of 5.1 million in August. Well, the discovery of widespread but small amounts of water on the surface of the moon stands now as one of the most surprising findings in planetary science. Three spacecraft picked up the signature of water, not just in the frigid polar craters where it has long been suspected to exist, but all over the lunar surface, which was previously thought to be bone dry. Except Richard C. Hoagland has always believed that there was water on the moon. How does he do it without billions of dollars of equipment? We'll find out next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, full hour here with our science advisor, head of the EnterpriseMission.com and DarkMission.net, Richard C. Hoagland, who's been traveling, I understand, all around this planet. Richard, how are you?
Hi there, George. Yes, we've been traveling.
Space shuttle or a jet plane?
Just regular aircraft.
Okay, so how do you do this, Richard? You don't have billions of dollars of satellite equipment and all this, but for years you've been saying there's water on Mars and there's water on Moon. How do you do this?
Well, you have to go back to the major model that separates what Enterprise has been doing from what NASA and the planetary science community have been doing. We've been looking at evidence that there are ruins now left by someone, probably the ancestors of the human race, all over the solar system. And where you have ruins, you have water. The only reason that you have ruins is because you have water. If you didn't have water, you wouldn't have life. You wouldn't have the capabilities of supporting any kind of an intelligent or even any kind of life form. So when I started watching this story develop over the last few days, to me it was amazingly confirmatory of the model that we've had for the moon for some time, which is there's a lot of junk there. There's a lot of ancient stuff, ruins left by someone, and where you have those ruins, you had to have water sources and a way to support, you know, from the numbers and the size of what we've been seeing, probably millions of people. So I am probably one of the least surprised at what NASA reported this morning. But in one sense, it's an astonishing surprise, and it's an astonishing coincidence for someone who doesn't believe in coincidence. Uh-huh. And we'll get to the coincidence a little later in the hour. But this has got to be probably the most remarkable day in space science, maybe in my professional career.
That's pretty amazing. Now, are they still going to use this probe in October where they were supposed to blast a massive hole or crater in the moon and just to see if there's water vapor? Why do that now?
This whole thing about NASA bombing the moon is such a nonsense story. What they're going to do in October, on October 9th, in the wee hours of October 9th, for those of us, you know, west of the Mississippi, they're going to drop a spent upper rocket stage called a Centaur rocket, which has been, you know, developed for the last, you know, 40 years.
Yeah.
And they're going to drop this on the moon at impact velocities as one would come down from outer space, pulled in by the moon's gravity. And when it hits, it will convert that kinetic energy of motion, of speed, of velocity, to basically a mini explosion. And I've seen all kinds of bizarre claims that this is going to be megatons of explosive energy. Not, it's equivalent to about one car bomb in Baghdad. It's about one ton of TNT equivalent, and it will produce a really tiny crater, of which on the moon there are millions and millions and millions of craters this size. It'll be a crater about the size of a small house. It'll be maybe 15, 20 feet deep, maybe 60, 70 feet wide. If you didn't know it was going to happen, you would never know it had happened, because it's going to be lost among millions of other comparable-sized craters on the moon, for gosh sakes. And the only reason that this is really now intriguing and compounds what was announced today is because the results that NASA announced today are from the surface. They're from looking at the moon, right, remote sensing equipment, looking at the top few millimeters of the soil.
Are these like almost lake beds, or at least they once had lake beds?
No, not like that. Well, we have to kind of limb out what this model is in a minute. But let me finish on this experiment in October. So what's going to happen in October is this spent rocket stage will produce the equivalent of about one ton of TNT exploded. It'll produce a crater that goes down maybe 15, 20 feet. And so it's going to get a chance to look under the surface in one of these permanently shaded craters at the south pole of the moon. Now, based on what's happened today, the announcement today, that there appears to be a film of water all over the moon, including at the equator at high noon, where it's 250 degrees, you know, above zero.
Yeah.
That indicates that water, unless it leaves the moon permanently, has to go somewhere. It kind of crab walks across the surface, hip hops, skips, whatever you want to call the molecular motion. And it winds up in these dark, permanently dark craters at the lunar poles, which, by the way, it turns out now from the preliminary Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter data, that's the spacecraft NASA put in orbit a few months ago, an unmanned spacecraft about the size of a small bus, which is looking and probing and scanning the moon now with really incredibly interesting instrumentation. It has measured the temperatures inside some of these permanently shadowed craters for the first time in modern history. And it's found that they are the coldest places in the solar system, notwithstanding even places on Pluto and in the, you know, the Kuiper Belt, billions of miles from the sun. And the reason is these craters at the lunar south pole and north pole, permanently shadowed, never see sunlight. And the heat soak through the moon is so small, the moon material is such an incredibly good insulator, that these craters literally are something like 400 degrees below zero Fahrenheit.
Jeez.
Now, you know, absolute zero is what, minus 425, something like that? I forget the exact number. But this is close to absolute zero. Now, in those incredibly frigid cold temperatures, in a place that never sees sunlight, these little molecules of water vapor that are being released everywhere on the moon, they migrate to what are called the cold traps, and then they get frozen permanently. So what the LaCrosse experiment, what this dropping of the Centaur stage in October is going to do, is to blow a little small crater in the bottom of one of those permanently shadowed, you know, big craters, loft this stuff up into sunlight, which it hasn't seen for maybe even billions of years. It will vaporize, and then the instrumentation, both in lunar orbit, in terms of the cross satellite itself, which is following on behind the impact, and even observatories on Earth, the big guys in Hawaii and Chile and, you know, Southern California, everybody with a decent telescope is going to be looking at the moon that wee hours of the morning, and doing spectral scans and records so they can see if this stuff blasted up from this one ton equivalent of TNT actually contains the water that's been cold trapped from process of accumulation from the rest of the moon that now these other spacecraft have told us about.
Absolute zero, by the way, minus 459.67 Fahrenheit.
Thank you.
Sent to us by one of your fans and our listeners.
Okay.
Now, what does this tell you, though, Richard, about what the moon might have looked like a long time ago with this water? Did it have an atmosphere? Did something happen to it?
Yes, and maybe, and yes. And I mean, look, this opens up an astonishing set of possibilities. In fact, what I was struck by at this morning's press conference was how many times the scientists, in their droll, conservative manners, looked in the camera and said, "This is amazing. This is unprecedented. This is mind-boggling. We didn't believe this." I mean, this is why, I mean, some of these observations go back 10 years, George, from the first spacecraft that recorded this was the Cassini mission en route to Saturn. And as you know, when you have a big spacecraft and you're using something primitive like rockets, you got to use little tricks of the trade to get out to the outer solar system. So what they do is they swing by the Earth and use the gravitational pull of the Earth to kind of slingshot them into the outer reaches way distant from the sun. During this slingshot maneuver of Cassini back in August of 1999, they did a spectral scan with an instrument on board of the moon for, quote, calibration purposes. And they saw this little smidgen of water recorded in that scan, and they didn't believe it. The reason they didn't is because when you assemble these instruments here on Earth, we've got lots of water, right?
Yeah.
Water in every breath, water in every technician, water in everybody's bodies. I mean, what, we're 90% water, something like that?
Mm-hmm.
The atmosphere has an enormous amount of water vapor in it. So water clings to instruments we send into space even months and years after they are launched into a hard vacuum. So what NASA says, and we can separate what they say from whether we believe what they say, but they claim that when they saw this little trace, you know, 10 years ago, they didn't think it was real because they thought it was a contamination from all the water vapor that these spacecraft take with them when they leave the Earth.
Yeah, geez.
Now we fast forward the film, and we've got the Indian mission, the Chandrayaan mission, which was launched 10 months ago, which went into lunar orbit 60 miles up, you know, a few weeks after it was launched.
Is that the one they've lost contact with now?
This is the one that they lost contact with, and you know, it had some kind of instrument failure, primarily because the lunar environment was a lot warmer than they had built the spacecraft to withstand.
Ah.
And that gets into a whole other set of questions, like, why is the moon warmer? Why is Mars warmer? Why is Neptune warmer? The solar system is undergoing solar system warming. Global warming is not just a problem for the Earth. It's a problem, as David Wilcock and I wrote in 2004 in a series of papers we published in Enterprise, which is still there. It is a problem for all the planets we can see. They've all been mysteriously getting warmer and warmer and more energetic. Well, the warming of the moon, for mysterious reasons, did in the Chandrayaan spacecraft after 10 months. But before it died, it had this interesting little gadget on board, an imaging spectrometer. What that means is it can basically take pictures and different colors of different elements.
And then they analyze it.
And then
they
analyze the minerals and the elements, and you can actually see them as maps. You don't have to do a point by point by point. The instrument is basically a spectral camera, so you can actually get composition data as well as pretty pictures. And when they started scanning the moon, the first scans, they found evidence that there was this weird, anomalous water. And they didn't believe it.
It is a dramatic story, Richard. Hold on. We'll come right back with you. Well, next hour, reporter Linda Moulton Howe will join us. She has been roving all over the country and even far off beyond that. So she'll be with us next hour. When we come back, Richard C. Hoagland with us with more on his incredible journeys on Coast to Coast AM. With all these things going on with NASA, Richard, have you updated Dark Mission yet? I know you were working on that with Mike.
As a matter of fact, this is that weird, bizarre coincidence. We have a new edition, a revised edition of Dark Mission, which technically is not published until October 6th, I think, which is 3 days before the NASA impact.
Mm-hmm.
But it's available as a pre-order now through Amazon, and there are some bookstores that apparently have it. And the reason this is so amazing is because in the revised edition, which has about 50 additional pages and a lot of really amazing imagery, including ruins on the moon, which have been recorded, photographed by amateur astronomers from Earth. I have three separate amateur astronomers in various parts of the world, one in Italy, one in the Midwest, and one, I think, in Canada, who independently all have photographed these astonishing artificial ruin-like structures on the moon from Earth with relatively small amateur telescopes and CCD cameras. And this is an enormous breakthrough in our effort to get the ruins on the moon taken seriously, because what this means, and which is described at great length in Dark Mission, in the revised edition, is that what we now have been able to do is to, because of this, democratize the search and confirmation for ruins on the lunar surface. We don't have to depend on NASA or ESA or the Japanese or the Chinese or anybody, because any amateur with decent equipment from Earth anytime now can point at these objects that we lay out in the book in terms of latitude and longitude, and they can confirm, and in color, in multispectral views, in all kinds of exquisite detail, what we have been claiming for years, which is that there are ruins on the moon. Now, here's the coincidence, George.
Okay.
At this morning's press conference, when Dr. Carly Peters, who was the principal investigator for the Chandrayaan mapper, spectral mapper, which found this water initially and prompted the search to go and look at other spacecraft data to confirm it, when she put up her graphics, her maps of where the water on the moon is, the highest concentration as seen by these spacecraft is in a northern latitude right almost on the prime meridian of the moon, which is the line that faces basically the Earth as the moon goes around the Earth. It faces one side faces the Earth all the time. And that crater called Goldschmidt is exactly where these lunar ruins that have been photographed by amateurs are located.
Go figure, right? That's
which
something.
Which brings me to the model for how I'm explaining what NASA's announced versus how NASA's explaining it. Let me go through the NASA model first.
Yeah, all right.
When NASA saw this stuff, which was now going back 10 years, and didn't believe it because everybody knew post-Apollo the moon is bone dry. It's drier than the driest desert on Earth you can ever imagine. So when these readings started coming in, the scientists involved, the geologists, looked at the data and said, "Ah, come on, it's got to be an instrument artifact. It cannot possibly be real. We all know there's no water on the moon, right?" So the explanation now that they've had three separate confirmations, and Carly Peters said, it's unequivocal. It's really there. As amazing as that is, unbelievable, it's really there, and it's all over
all
the moon,
over it.
Which is astonishing. I mean, look, you and I live on Earth, right, George?
I think I do sometimes.
We know that water is found in underground rivers and in springs and in lakes and in reservoirs and whatever, but there isn't water everywhere on the surface of the Earth, unless you're on the ocean, right?
That's right.
On dry land, water tends to segregate in certain regions, and you have to bring it to other regions. And, you know, drilling wells is not a walk in the park sometimes. It's in the atmosphere, but, of course, the moon has no atmosphere, so you can't invoke that as an explanation. So the standard model now that NASA is beginning to kind of look at seriously is that this water is really not on the moon. It's actually manufactured by the interaction of the solar wind, because we all orbit inside the sun, in essence.
Okay.
Even though you can't see the thin gaseous atmosphere streaming off from the sun, which is overwhelmingly hydrogen, we are, the orbit of the Earth is inside the solar corona, which is the solar wind, which has a lot of this hydrogen. And, of course, water is hydrogen and oxygen, right?
Sure.
So where does the oxygen come from? In the NASA model, the reason that they think they're seeing it everywhere on the moon is because it's being manufactured when the hydrogen in the solar wind hits the surface of the moon, which is a silicate surface with a lot of oxygen. And there's a chemistry process that manufactures a little bit of water on every square inch exposed to the solar wind during the daytime. And that's how they're explaining this amazing discovery that there is this trace of water everywhere on the day side of the moon that the instruments were looking.
Do you agree with that?
No. No. And the reason I don't is because we don't have the time to go into all the reasons why I don't. One of the possibilities that they mentioned this morning at the press conference that could explain what they're seeing is that instead of being produced by the solar wind interacting with the lunar surface, the water is actually percolating up from underneath, further down toward the lunar core.
That's dramatic.
And is leaking out all over the moon. Now, think about that. What kind of physical process could possibly give rise to water coming up, upwelling, so that every square mile they looked at, from the North Pole to the equator to the South Pole, has lunar water during the daytime recorded by these instruments on spacecraft that were flying by or orbiting overhead? That doesn't make much sense. I mean, why isn't water on the moon localized like water is on Earth by geology, or water is on Mars by geology, et cetera, et cetera? The answer is, I think the water is coming from buried lunar ruins, the buried cities, because you've got what's on the moon called regolith, which is really rubble. It's really dust and dirt and rock and other stuff from an awful lot of activity that's happened after whoever was on the moon and built those amazing things we see in ruins here and there had disappeared, become extinct, went away, died, you know, vanished into history, whatever term you want to use. If there's a lot of artificial stuff buried under the surface that we see, and it's coming up through cracks in the surface regolith, in that kind of frothy soil-like material, which has been pounded and pounded and pounded by meteors for millions and not billions of years, then you've got a lot of fissures where whatever's going on underneath, if it leaks out, it goes up toward a vacuum. In other words, gases have a pressure, and they will go from, you know, higher pressure to lower pressure, right? Well, you can't have a lower pressure than a vacuum on the surface, so the stuff is continually coming up, and it's vaporizing. It's being it's boiling because the temperature of the moon at the equator is 250 degrees Fahrenheit above zero, and the NASA guys can't understand why they're actually seeing it even during high noon. It's like if there was a limited reservoir of water somehow just beneath the surface, you'd expect in millions of years it would be depleted.
Absolutely.
There's got to be a continual renewal, which means there's got to be cubic miles, George, of contained volumes of atmosphere under the surface that we see. In structures that have been buried but are still kind of intact. And as they break down, as walls collapse, as airlocks, you know, degrade, as rust, you know, produces holes, that water vapor that was contained in those structures leaks out, works its way to the surface, and is coming out, in essence, all over the moon, because that's how much stuff was once built. I mean, think of Los Angeles basically on a lunar scale.
Right.
In ruins, underneath rubble.
And then water just seeping up.
It seeps out. Now, what's really cool is this is a testable model, which ultimately we will know the answer. And because the water is such an important economic resource in terms of exploring the moon, of sustaining astronauts, sustaining a lunar base.
Maybe even terraforming it one day. Who knows?
Exactly. Sustaining tourism. There's going to be an awful lot of scientists and NASA money now looking to explain where this water is coming from. And they won't be able to suppress the ultimate answer if the answer is what I just laid out.
Why didn't the Apollo astronauts report seeing or noticing some type of water if it's so widespread, even in small amounts, if it's all over the moon?
Well, remember, it's in a vaporous form. It is a trace. The only reason we're seeing it is because the instrumentation is so sensitive. And by the time the astronauts brought the rocks that they collected back to Earth, all the water had evaporated.
It's that fast? Okay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because we're talking trace amounts. But when you look at the 15 million square miles of lunar surface, I mean, they were tossing around numbers today like, if you processed a ton of the surface, which is, let's say, a few millimeters deep, and how many, you know, 1,000 square feet would you have to mine the top few millimeters, you would get about a quart of water per ton of lunar soil. Now, that's an estimate. They really don't know because they don't know how deep this is. But the problem is that as soon as you loaded it up and put it in those boxes, you know, the soil and the rocks, and then brought it home, and then uncorked it in the laboratory in Houston, the water had evaporated and just went into the air.
It was gone.
It was gone. Now, what they're looking for, let me back up. During the Apollo analyses of the rocks, there were some reports of finding trace amounts of water in the rocks from the moon. And again, they were all rejected as spurious and contamination because we all know there can't be any water on the moon. See what I mean? So you have a tautology. You have a self-fulfilling negative expectation, which went on and on and on until they were literally hit over the head by three separate spacecraft, all saying and confirming the same astonishing fact, which is there appears to be water coming out of almost every square foot of the lunar surface, which is not normal. I don't care what you say, George, that is not normal geology.
No, it's not normal.
And it also does not appear, if you really look at it, it doesn't appear that this solar wind model is going to hold up. I mean, that's kind of their arm-waving, desperate, we got to explain this somehow, and that's the first obvious possibility. But even the scientists today said that there were problems with that model, and I can tell you one right away. What? When they looked at the lunar surface from dawn to dusk, when you start out at the dawn terminator, you have a lot of water, relatively speaking, in these instruments that they were detecting. Then as the moon rotates and you get around to high noon, when the temperatures go to about 250 above, the water kind of leaches out and you don't have almost any. But then as the moon continues to rotate and you go around to the evening terminator or sunset, the water built back up. And it appears to be irrespective of local topology, mountains, craters, brightness, reflectivity, chemical composition. The only thing that seems to determine how much water there was at any moment was the temperature of the surface, which was dependent on the angle of sunlight, whether it was morning, noon, or night. And that supports really nicely a model that says it's coming up from inside, it freezes at night. As soon as the sun hits that surface, it thaws and it vaporizes the water on the surface. There's a finite amount. That means it gets very low during high noon. But as you get down toward the evening, the temperatures fall. The water's percolating up from underneath.
Keeps coming.
It keeps coming, and it builds up the reservoir again. And I'm going to bet you dollars to Navy beans that's the ultimate explanation. And then the only reason that can possibly be real would be if there's a lot of ancient buildings under that regolith which are collapsing and releasing their atmosphere, including the water vapor, ultimately to the vacuum of space coming up through the porous, you know, granules of the lunar soil.
That's dramatic. I want you to update us on the NBC special in a moment. Let's take a couple quick calls. Port Angeles, Washington. Go ahead, Tom. You're on with Richard C.
Howdy, George. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Mr. Hoagland, as by the screener, I really wonder why there's any uproar over there being water on the moon at all. This solar system came down out of the same pattern and the same rotations, right, where all the water was present in the first place. Not to mention the fact that the Earth and all of its water has been hammered by large asteroidal impact, and that's been kicked up, and that could have been picked up. I really wouldn't be surprised if there were diatoms and rhyotomes to be found on the moon or even in comets.
He may be right there, Richard.
Well, he's right because they already have. Some years ago, Steve Troy and I reported on the Russians and their unmanned sampling of areas on the moon like Mare Crisium. And you can actually go to Enterprise and you will see some papers. You can actually search it also on Google, so it will take you to the actual URL. The Russians reported with micro photographs little tiny diatoms and other microbes they had found in their lunar samples brought back with unmanned probes that fired them up into the cislunar space between Earth and Moon and dropped them in the Indian Ocean. They brought them back to laboratories in Moscow, opened them up in a clean room, and lo and behold, there were little microbes, dead microbes, fossilized microbes, in the lunar soil that they brought back. I mean, they literally brought back little pinches, like thimblefuls of soil, and yet they found microbes. Now, what does that say?
These are going to be great discoveries. Hey, what's going on with the NBC Sci-Fi special on 2012 in November?
Well, they have got a finished product. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm hearing some very good things. It will be 2 hours on the evening of November 13th, which is the night that Roland Emmerich is debuting his big blockbuster 2012 major motion picture. And what you will see in the NBC Sci-Fi special, starring yours truly and a few other people like David Wilcock and George Noory and some others, is basically a look at the physics of 2012, the hyperdimensional torsion field physics model that I have been talking about for so many years, will be laid out for the first time to a mainstream audience, and we're expecting some very interesting reactions. In the interim, remember, we have just published this revised edition of Dark Mission, and everything you need to know about the background to this stunning discovery and announcement of liquid water on the moon, including the highest concentration at the place where these ruins are that we've now spotted on amateur CCD imagery from the Earth with moderate amateur telescopes, is in the revised edition of Dark Mission. So I would recommend that you either go to Amazon or you go to darkmission.net or you go to your local bookstore and get a copy, because there is going to be some more surprises in the weeks to come.
You're full of surprises. Richard, thank you for these updates. Back in a moment with Linda Moulton Howe next.